Save 10% on your next domain registration at GoDaddy.com by using the coupon code CHRIS1. That's Chris and the number one.
We're at Dave Weiner's house, and Dave decided to have a weekend where his parents were going to actually come down into town, and they didn't make it because his dad was feeling sick. And Dave is having his friends over for dinner. I think about 15 of us are here. We're all sitting around having wonderful Thai, Laotian food. And the conversation goes to archiving. People have such passionate opinions about archiving. Some were saying, oh my God, there's so much information. Who cares? We don't need to archive all that. And then others were saying it's very important to archive. Jeff Ubois spoke up, and he is working on a website called
www.archival.tv.
Has a lot to say about archiving, and I'm sure you want to hear about it. So I thought I'd pull him into the den and get some information from him that I know you'd love to hear. So tell us a little bit about what you do and what you believe in when it comes to archiving.
Sure. Well, my name is Jeff Ubois. I am at a website called www.archival.tv. I work on another website also called ptvdigitalarchive.org, and that is a website for a project to preserve digital public television. That's funded by the Library of Congress, and it's run from 13, which is the public broadcasting station in New York, which is thinking about how to work archival preservation into the production of educational television. But it's also, in a larger sense, about retrieving the last 60 years of our history and making it publicly accessible. If you think about what's the most vivid record of the last 60 years, it's stuff that's been on television. It's television news. And for the most part, you really can't get access to it. It's very hard to go back and see a newscast or an old program that might describe something really important. But if I asked you, where would you go see a video of the moon landing or the Vietnam War or Kennedy's assassination or the Korean War or a presidential speech, I think you'd find it very challenging to go back and get access to that broadcast, let alone to comment on it, share it with other people, discuss it, and think about it. And that's a problem in our public dialogue, right? If you have no cultural memory, it's very hard to have an intelligent public discussion.
And how did you get started into this side of archiving?
Well, I really got into it through Brewster Kahle of the Internet Archive. So when Brewster was leaving AOL, he was thinking about what to do next, and he said, well, I want to preserve the web. I want to save web pages. And this was in 1995, and people all asked him, are you crazy? Why would you want to save web pages? These are all things that, you know, they're mostly garbage, and they're going to go away, and nobody will need to look at them again. And Brewster had, I think, a very sharp intuition about the future value of these, you know, essentially cultural artifacts or documentation of what was going on then in society. And he picked a project which was to archive all the websites of the presidential campaigns in 1996. So I worked on that for him, and we wrapped that up into an exhibit that went into the Smithsonian in Washington in their, you know, Americana political memorabilia area. So that was kind of the first demonstration that these web pages, which people thought of as kind of, you know, the equivalent of the free local paper, were preserved for historical reasons, that there was some historical significance to them. So Brewster now runs the Internet Archive, which has got, I'll leave it open, I believe. Sorry, you're going to have to edit that. It's a couple of petabytes worth of web pages from the last 12 years, as well as a large collection of musical recordings, spoken word recordings, software, games, books, and television. So,
what is a petabyte? How much information is in a petabyte? I'm afraid to ask.
A petabyte is 1,000,000 gigabytes.
Oh my gosh.
So it's 1,000 terabytes. It's a lot. Yeah.
That's amazing.
So in fact, one of the things that I think Brewster does that impresses some people and annoys others is he starts to use the Library of Congress as a unit of measure. You know, we have 47 libraries of Congress in this server rack because, we should look up the number because it's not right at hand. The point is that when you start dealing with that quantity of data, you can make a comparison to the amount of text in the Library of Congress. So the Library of Congress has got something like 26 million books. You can run out the numbers in order to make a estimate of how much data that is, but it's less than what's in the Internet Archive now.
I'm just shaking my head because just to try to fathom what that would be like if it were all printed, if it were all put into books. There's no way to measure.
Well, I think that's actually one of the things that's been very interesting is that over the last few years, there's been kind of a change in the belief in the use of hard disks as an archival medium. If you look in some publications now, like I was at the Association of Moving Images conference in Alaska last year, and one of the ads was from Kodak, and the ad said, "Kodak film, it's still the one true archival medium." So, you know, the assertion is ground up cow bones are the things that you want to use to preserve culture on. And to an extent, they're right. You know, film is a more durable medium than hard disks. Hard disks fail and they take a lot of data with them. So if you think about, you know, your personal collection or your friends' collections of the photos of their kids, they're probably very vulnerable. So one of the things that's happening is that more and more of our belongings are becoming digital, and our memories and the cultural productions that we have are born digital, and they're written to a medium that is very fragile. And so on the one hand, people who are concerned with long-term preservation are quite concerned that it's really easy to lose all of your photographs or all of your sound recordings, all of your podcasts in one bad hard disk failure. At the same time, there's a recognition that digitizing what we have, whether it's books in the library or museum artifacts or old television broadcasts or microfilm that was taken 60 years ago and is now time to migrate from microfilm to some more searchable medium, that moving things out of vaults and onto disk makes it much more accessible and much more usable by a much larger number of people. And so then there are a lot of questions about, you know, how do you finance that and what does it mean to have those things that were formerly very difficult to access suddenly very easy to access, or at least possible to access. So in the archiving world, people think a lot about preservation, mechanisms for long-term preservation, and that may mean anything from the design of institutions that can be trusted to last a long time, to the design of technologies which preserve information reliably. And there is a bunch of barriers to that. If you think about all the ways you can lose data, like the operating system changes, or the applications you're used to using change, or the hardware associated with them is no longer available, or the standards that were thought to be likely to remain a long time, you know, go out of fashion. Like, you know, you may have some old WordStar files or CPM disks or 5 1/4 inch disks, and you can't read them anymore. So from an archival perspective, you've lost that information. And designing our software and our computers now to last a long time is on the minds of a lot of people. I'm kind of rambling here.
So tell me what that means for just a regular person at home with all of their information. What's the smartest way for us to archive our own personal information? I know that I blogged about just the other day, you know, for whatever reason, my family gave all of the family photos to me, because just because we're in the computer business, that they believe that it's our responsibility. And so now I feel like I have all this responsibility of all these photos, and I need to sit and scan them all and put them on disk and give them to everybody. But who has the time to do that? And I saw this awesome little commercial, I have to say it, from Kodak, where they have this van. It's a new thing. It's in, only in Southern California, I think in the Bay Area here, where they have this van that will go around, and for so much per hour, they will come and scan all your photos for you and put them on disk. And then you can burn that disk and give it to all your family members. And I swear this is like the greatest thing since sliced bread. If I could do it, this would be the Christmas present that everyone would love and the whole family of the family history. So tell me about it on a small scale. Like, how can we at home work with archiving? And then we'll move to the Library of Congress.
That's a great issue. I don't think there's any single solution that's been arrived at that's perfect. But you can think in terms of some principles for it. So one is lots of copies helps. Lots of copies on different kinds of media. Having multiple custodians in your family is good. Some of the online services like Amazon's S3 or X Drive may be interesting if you use them, if you use multiple ones of them, because you don't know which one's going to go out of business when. Lots of people put up a website and their ISP goes under or has a hard disk failure, and those items are gone. Kodak has also come out with some CDs and DVDs that are intended to be very long lasting. We don't really know how long they'll last, but you know, the intention is decades. There are a couple of services like MPEG Silo that work to take your films and, you know, home movies, like 8mm home movies, and digitize them so you can share those with your family, but then they will also keep those 8mm movies in cold storage. So one of the things about the personal collections is keep the originals. That's one thing that's a good practical thing to do. Don't just assume that because you've scanned it on a hard disk once that it's safely preserved. That's actually related to a problem that Dave's working on very seriously, which is how do you preserve your writings on the web? And if you think about this sort of slow accretion of material over the course of your, you know, the last, I don't know how long you've been blogging, but I would guess for a while, and you think about, you know, now you have quite this large collection of stuff, but it's in a format that's probably going to change, may not be readable in 20 or 30 years. It's important now for people to start thinking about how to put it into a form that will last.
Another question I had was with banking on a personal level. You know, the banks will ask you, you know, do you want your canceled checks, or do you want us to keep your canceled checks? Mm-hmm. And we keep them and we store them. And anytime you need it, you just call us up and you're going to get a copy of it. Do people ask you about this, and how do you handle that on a personal level? Guru of archiving here.
I'm not sure there's a good answer for that, really. One nice thing about the financial records is generally you don't need to keep them for more than 7 years. So there's kind of a statutory thing. That's not something that you need to plan to bequeath to your great-great-great-grandchildren. So having a definite time horizon like that means that, you know, you can maybe be a little more sanguine about relying on a couple of backup copies or an encrypted file left online or something left with your bank. The other question about that with any kind of archival thing like that is, how do you want to re-encounter the material later? How do you want to be able to find it again later? So there's a question about how much effort do you want to expend now in order to mark it up in some way that makes it easy to search for later. So you can imagine taking all of your receipts and throwing them in one shoebox.
Which we've all done, come on.
Which nobody ever would do. And you'd sort of know it's there. or you could imagine having a very elaborate filing system. So I think, you know, one of the things about financial records or photographs is how much preparation do you want to put into it up front? What is the prospective value later? And that's one of the hardest questions about archiving, is that you are making judgments about the future value of material, and it's very difficult to make those kinds of calls. You don't know what's going to be important to you in the future.
So do you have a shoebox or do you use neat receipts?
I'm much more on the shoebox end of the scale. More of the cobbler's children when it comes to records like that.
And that's because you're working so much on the big picture rather than the small picture. So let's go back to that. Let's talk more about the television side. I know that's where your primary focus is, correct?
Yeah. Let me give you a story that got me into this, because again, this is an idea from Brewster Kahle, and he brought up the question, well, suppose someone like an educator wanted to reconstruct the interaction between Dan Quayle and Murphy Brown. Do you remember this? So Rodney King is stopped by LA police. He's beaten. That beating is videotaped. It's broadcast on the news. There are riots in Los Angeles when the police officers who are responsible for the beating are acquitted. The vice president, Dan Quayle, comes to San Francisco, goes to LA, and then he goes to San Francisco, and he's in the Commonwealth Club, and he says, well, the reason people were rioting is because they're brought up with bad values, and those bad values are amplified by Hollywood in television dramas like Murphy Brown, where you have a single mom. So it's not racism, it's not economic inequality, it's not problems with the police that have been persistent and are now made obvious through the King videotape that caused the riots. It's all these single moms and Hollywood's sitcom. And, you know, that caused quite a controversy, and it was kind of the lead story on the news. And the people who made the Murphy Brown show made a show in response to Dan Quayle's comments. And if you think about all the places where that interaction might be useful in an educational setting, you know, history, media, journalism, sociology, race and economic studies, studies about Los Angeles, you know, it's broadly useful in an educational context, an important part of history, and each one of those pieces that happened on television is under a sort of a different part of the copyright law. Like, you know, so the president speaking is very different from a bit of entertainment footage, or the vice president speaking. In fact, George Bush was asked about this, standing with the leaders of the G7, and people are asking him questions about Murphy Brown, and the White House, you know, initially agrees with him, then disagrees with Quayle and tries to distance itself. So there's this big drama about it happening under all kinds of different copyright regimes on different channels, commercial and non-commercial. And so Brewster said, well, what if you wanted to go back and find what happened and reconstruct that history? Could you do it? And I tried. And it turned out that it wasn't really possible to do. The folks at Warner Brothers didn't want to make the Murphy Brown episode available. The Commonwealth Club had the Dan Quayle speech for sale on its website, but in fact they had transferred the records to the Hoover Institution. The Hoover Institution said, well, you know, we haven't really got that in a convenient form, and besides, it's locked up with copyright. So, you know, you can't get this footage of Dan Quayle. Several of the news networks had footage, but it was often very expensive. NBC wanted $20 a second for use of that footage. So for an educator, So it was actually a very strange research project in the sense that every denial of access was interesting rather than frustrating. If I had been trying to teach a class, I would have been upset. But here's, you know, so anyway, the point is, here's this bit of our history that's being kept dark for a whole bunch of reasons, ranging from institutional inertia to copyright problems to the latest technology not being applied to making things accessible. And that cuts across the board. That's true for almost everything that you'll see on television. It's still very hard to go back and see what happened. So it's easy for people to make assertions that aren't true. So right now there's a short clip out that was done by Robert Greenwald. He did the Fox News documentary, Outfoxed. So Outfoxed was put together. He got a large number of people to videotape Fox News, and they started to they started to look for patterns in the types of broadcasts that Fox News did, and they started to look for inconsistencies between, Bill O'Reilly saying, "I never tell anyone to shut up," and then they have six instances of Bill O'Reilly saying, "Shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up." So he's done another one on McCain right now called McCain versus McCain, and it's McCain saying things about controversial issues that directly contradict some previous assertion. So going from this medium that has no memory to one that has a memory, I think, is really going to change public dialogue in some very interesting ways. And that's exciting. I think that that's going to be a big theme in 2008. People are going to find it much easier to go back and find things that their opponents have said. And you can imagine that being abused. I mean, selective memory is not the same thing as truth. I mean, one of the interesting things about video is it causes an emotional reaction in people before you can even think about it. You know, the face appears on the screen, you have an emotional reaction, and it colors your subsequent thinking. But it's a huge step forward if you can at least go back and check, if you can at least go back and see what has occurred. And so I think we're moving in that direction with television news, and I think that'll have a huge effect on public dialogue. So I'm excited about that.
And what kind of work have you seen that's been very productive and very evolutionary in this area? Well, first I should say, how long did it take you to research the Dan Quayle issue and then come up empty-handed? How much time did you spend on that before you finally just said, you know what, it's not going to happen, and I've spent too much time on trying to make this happen?
Well, there's sort of two dimensions to that. So one is elapsed time, right? You can write a request to a library, museum, archive, broadcast network, and you can wait. You know, you may not hear back, you may ask again. So there's a long elapsed time on this of more than a year in terms of, you know, from the time that I sent the first request for a broadcast of some time to the point where I wrote up the results. And I had multiple requests outstanding. And then in terms of actual time interacting with networks or trying to find things in libraries, several hundred hours. So I wrote this up, and you can find a copy of it in the Journal of Digital Information. It's called Finding Murphy Brown. If you Google for Finding Murphy Brown, or you Google for Dan Quayle Murphy Brown television news or whatever, you'll find it. Annalee Newitz did kind of a short summary of it. So if you look at Texploitation, look for Texploitation Murphy Brown, you'll also run into it. Mm-hmm. Sorry, you had more.
So tell us more about your website and your blog.
Oh, sure. Well, I'm sporadic at it, but my website's at www.archival.tv. I've been thinking about some of the public-private partnerships that are going on now. One of the dynamics around archiving as things go digital is that most museums, libraries, and archives don't have a lot of money. They don't have the money or the technical expertise to digitize their collections. And so what's happening is you're seeing a lot of commercial organizations offer to go into some kind of partnership with them. So someone will knock on the door and say, "Hi, I'm from a commercial institution. We have lots of money and expertise at digitizing collections like yours. And we're a business, so we want to have some exclusive right to the digital copies that we make of your materials for some period of time in exchange for our services. And as part of our negotiations, we'd like you to sign an NDA. And so what's happening is a library system, and the librarians are being isolated from each other through this mechanism of non-disclosure agreements requested by their commercial partners. So one project that I think is really interesting is called MetaVid. It's based at the University of Santa Cruz, and they are taking recordings from C-SPAN, and they are removing anything that smacks of copyright from C-SPAN, and they're building a system that makes it very easy to annotate speeches made on the floor of Congress. And that's pretty exciting. That's a case where you really want what's been broadcast on C-SPAN to be easy to find and easy to access and easy to remix and annotate and share and point to. So MetaVid is an interesting project in this archiving TV area, and has a great, I think it'll have great political relevance in 2008.